Welcome to this edition of the HPE Mission Critical Solutions podcast, which is jointly sponsored by Intel. This podcast series explores how customers are deploying HPE's high-end servers that are powered by platinum and gold Intel scalable processors for their most demanding application workloads. Indeed, in this podcast, we will discuss an extraordinary workload in the realm of data analytics. I am honored to be joined by Dr. James Ferguson, lecturer with the Centre for Theoretical Cosmology at the University of Cambridge in the UK. Welcome, Dr. Ferguson.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm going to ask Dr. Ferguson just five questions about the work that he does and some of the IT that supports his work. And the first point is, you know, please tell us about the Centre for Theoretical Cosmology and your particular areas of research.
Okay, so the Centre for Theoretical Cosmology's mission really is to create mathematical theories that describe our universe and then to try and confront them with observational data to advance our understanding of the universe. Now, in this task, we primarily focus in this department in the most extreme events in the universe, where our current theories are at their limit. For example, in things like black holes, black hole collisions, and also in the Big Bang, where the universe was created itself. My research primarily is focused on the latter, the Big Bang, and specifically inflation, which is our best theory of how the universe began. This is the idea that at the very beginning of time, space itself underwent a very rapid expansion, creating the conditions for which the universe we can see today would evolve naturally. And when I say rapid, I really mean it's really rapid. So inflation predicts that in a tiny fraction of a second, it's actually a million billion times less than the time it takes a single piece of light to travel the width of an atom. Every centimeter in space was stretched to over 100 billion light years, which sounds ridiculous when you put it that way, but that's what the model tells us. And so I aim to constrain these models of inflation by looking for unusual correlations between different scales and data sets that we have, like the number of galaxies we have and things like that, saying, is there something that we see on the galaxy scale that's correlated with something that we see on a much larger or a much smaller scale? And these correlations tend to act as fingerprints for specific inflationary models. And so I've developed a pipeline that allows us to take those correlations and then map and say, which is the best inflationary model that fits that data?
Wow. I'll probably say wow a few times in this podcast, I think, but that is certainly very fundamental research that you're doing there. And I'll be honest with you, I've never heard of inflation termed in that sense before, but I definitely can understand where you're coming from. So my point number two is you're trying to understand events taking place billions of years ago and in an environment with many unknowns and seemingly endless in size and scope. It is amazing, as I said. How do cosmologists like yourself approach this problem?
Right, so, well, normally in science, standard scientific method is that you would come up with a theory and then you would go and conduct a number of experiments to check its validity. A simple example would be if you thought that a particular drug would treat a particular disease, you'd go on a trial with a number of people, maybe 1,000 people, with that particular disease, you'd give them the drug to half of them, and you would measure the average improvement, right? So now imagine you want to apply that same basic scientific method to cosmology. When you try and do that, there's two key problems you face. The first one is we only have one universe, which is like, in the previous example, only having one person to test the drug on. And it's actually worse than that, because we can't even do a test. All we can do to the universe is take pictures of it. You know, there's no way I can go out there and say, what would our universe look like if it had more black holes? Because I can't go out there and put more black holes in and see what would happen. All I can do is sit here on the ground, point my eyes at the sky, and just have a look at what I can see. And so this is the position we're in cosmology. It's sort of unique among sciences in a way that we can't actually do any, we call them experiments, but really they're just sort of fancy versions of cameras. We just take pictures of things that are there. Sometimes we take movies. Then we look at them really hard and work out what must be going on. And so to overcome this first problem, that we only have one universe, is we make our measurement, say we count how many galaxies weigh more, well, we maybe say what's the average weight of a galaxy? We go and measure this, and then what we'll do is we'll take our theories, and we have to create hundreds of simulations of the universe to see what each theory would predict, and then we have to ask which set of simulations best fits the measurement we had. So in some sense, rather than having one theory and lots of experiments where we measure it, we take one experiment, one measurement, and we have to do hundreds of versions of the theory to see which one fits best. And so this is what makes cosmology so numerically expensive. Because we essentially have to run models of the entire universe hundreds and hundreds of times. A good example of this is the Planck satellite that I'm involved in, which measures the oldest light in the sky. It comes from about 300,000 years after the Big Bang, which was 13.7 billion years ago. The actual data set is only a few gigabytes, so it's actually not very big. In order to analyze it, we use somewhere in the region of 100 million CPU hours. And that's in order to simulate both what the universe we get from the theory, and then we also have to simulate the specific experiment trying to observe that universe. So we get all the experimental problems in there as well. And so that's one of the real fundamental problems in cosmology. You have to sort of simulate everything. You can't just go out and test something more times to get a better error bar. You've got to guess it. For the second problem, which is that we can only take photos, the only solution is we just try and take really, really good photos. So for example, there's the Gaia experiment. It's a little telescope in space, essentially a camera. It's observing our own galaxy, looking to see where the stars are, how many stars are up there. And that has a resolution where it could resolve a single human hair at a distance of 1,000 kilometers. And so when I say we have really good photos, we do have really, really good photos.
Wow, that is quite something. I won't be thinking of telescopes in the same way from now on if they can have that sort of resolution. And this also gives special meaning to the term big data. It's going to be big with a capital B. In fact, we might call it huge data or colossal data, but let's stick with big data. Can you talk about the challenges you face in this area?
Yes, well, this is a really interesting point in cosmology because essentially we're undergoing a transformation. Data sets are sort of growing exponentially. Back in, as recently as 2000, the most important papers that were coming out in cosmology were, there was one that predicted that proved that dark energy exists, and that was done with 14 supernovae, so 14 data points. And then since then, with the growth of technology, we've been able to have much, much better data sets, much more detailed, full sky type ones. So with Planck, we now have a few hundred million pixels. And soon we're going to have billion surveys that look at a billion galaxies. And so the data sets are really growing fast. And if you look forward to the future, as soon as the mid-2020s, we're going to have experiments like the square kilometer array low frequency experiment. This is going to be a million radio antenna in the Australian outback, covering 150 square kilometers, I think. And this experiment, when it's running, will be generating around 170 terabytes of data every single second, all day, every day. And so this is beyond any possible amount, possible storage. Essentially, we'd fill up all of the world's data centers in a couple of months. And so what we have to do here is we actually have to analyze the data on the fly. We have to use a computer that will be three times larger than the largest supercomputer that currently is in existence. And the point of that computer is to be able to compress this data down to mere exabytes, which is, thousands of petabytes, which will be small enough that we can actually save it. And so to adapt to this flood of data, we really need much more powerful and flexible computing resources to be able to get to the answers fast. Academia often looks like a very calm and relaxed place to work. You imagine, people in poor, chosenly clothes and rooms, having very friendly conversations. The reality is that it's a very, very competitive environment. And the goal is always to be first. Silver medals, while they're good in the Olympics, they're no good in academia, right? No one cares if you're second. So our goal is always to try and find out how we can use these huge data sets and then find our shortest time to solution. How can we test our theory, get to an answer in the very, very shortest time?
Yeah, so that's data exploding at a phenomenal rate with the many challenges it brings. And you also raise a good point about competition there. One thinks of universities as perhaps being a kind of relaxed environment with little commercial or competitive imperative, but as you rightly point out, that is definitely not the case, which is good because actually competition fosters innovation. So point number four, A little over a year ago, and following a succession of systems from SGI, a new HPE Superdome Flex server was installed at your Cosmos computing facility in the UK. How is in-memory computing and Superdome Flex helping you tackle these challenges and accomplish your research?
Okay, so as I said before, the key thing we need from our computing resources to deal with these massive data sets is they have to be powerful. They also have to be very flexible, with one of the key points really being flexible. You know, the fundamental problem when you're doing research is that by definition, you don't know what you're doing. You know? Or to put it another way, you're attempting to always be out of your depth. And so this means we don't know what we're going to do in advance. And so when we think about time to solution, which is really the key measure for how well a system is performing for us, it has to include coming up with the idea, designing the code, prototyping, testing it, as well as the normal runtime. And this is where I think in-memory computing really comes into its own for us. With in-memory computing, we can avoid having to worry about complicated parallelization. We can have to worry about distributing the data with these very large data sets. And we can just get something up and running really quickly that will give us an answer. And if that answer turns out to be really important or really interesting, we can always come back and optimize it later and get it to run on whatever else. But the key thing is to get it running as soon as we possibly can, because that's really what counts. You know, we don't care if we're hitting the roofline model of really getting the maximum performance out of the machine. What we care is that we can write and develop a code and get to an answer in the shortest period of time. And that's what in-memory computing is really good. The other great advantage is you don't have to worry about complicated parallelized data distribution. It means there's a much lower barrier of entry. It means that I can take junior researchers and research students, and I can say, I've got this problem I want you to work on, and here's a small amount of training on computers, and they can get onto the system, and they can be effective. They can access the power of the system. Whereas on things like clusters or machine or GPUs or all of these other sort of technologies that are out there, they need a lot more training before they can access them. It's much more of a daunting challenge. It's much longer before they get something to actually work efficiently. And this is really important, actually, because I said there's always huge time pressures, but also PhD student will only have 3 years to produce something good enough to get in the next job. And one of the things about academia is it's very competitive. We tend to lose about half of everyone every career step, right? Only 3% of people who do PhDs end up as academics. So it's a very high rate of loss. And so you really want to make a real impression in these 3 years. And if you have to spend a year of that learning the intricacies of high-performance computing, that means you've got a lot less time to actually do the work. And so a system with a really low barrier of entry, like in-memory systems, are a huge advantage to getting students and postdocs involved and up and running very quickly with a minimum of training. I mean, there are many other advantages that come with in-memory computing. There's a clear speed gain when you deal with a large data set, if you can have it coherent in one memory space. I mean, I personally have a number of codes, and we've found that they run roughly 10 times faster on a in-memory system like Superdome Flex than they would on an even more powerful cluster, simply because in cosmology, we often have to look at all of the data. So we want to see everything at once. And so as soon as you distribute it, you really kill your performance. The other really great thing about in-memory is you can visualize it, the data really easily, because it's all in one place. You can draw plots, and that's, you know, there's no better diagnostic tool than the human eye, right? You can see a picture of what your code's doing. It's much easier to see if something's going wrong. It's also really nice for when we run simulations. We have a number of codes that run things like cosmic string networks, which are a very esoteric thing I won't get into, and black hole collisions. And you can see what's happening in the simulation as it's running. And you can see if you've set the initial conditions up wrong. You can see if maybe one of your terms isn't stable and there's some noise getting into it. And so it's a really nice way to be able to diagnose and to debug systems much faster if you can see what's happening. And that's possible if all the data is in one place.
Cool, thank you. So it's very interesting you talk about the value of in-memory computing there, and also the low barrier to entry, as you put it. And it strikes me that that, along with the competitive natures of universities, is there's the you know, commercial IT and academic IT has rather closer parallels than I had previously thought. So that's a very interesting insight. And Dr. Ferguson, my last point is this. I understand that you're not stopping still, you haven't solved all the problems of the universe. So to gain further insights about our universe, where is your research taking you now?
Well, so cosmology at the moment is at a really interesting place, and that we have a really good model of the universe. It is described by general relativity, and it says that we began with a period of inflation, and the universe contains 5% of normal stuff, like planets and people. It's got 25% dark matter, and it's got 70% dark energy. And this model is really good, actually. It matches our observations to like 1%. I mean, the only problem is we don't know what any of the constituents are. We don't really know what inflation is. We don't really know what dark matter is. And we definitely don't know what dark energy is. I mean, our best prediction for dark energy is wrong by 1 followed by 120 zeros, which I like to tell my students is the most wrong anyone's ever been in science. So as a result, most of the current work is searching for small effects which give us a clue as to the nature of these three remaining puzzles. What is inflation, what's dark matter, and what's dark energy? And this is hopefully what's going to come out of these vast data sets that we're currently acquiring. There's one other really exciting development, which has just started in the last couple of years, which is gravity wave astronomy. And this is looking for gravitational waves, actually the fabric of space-time oscillating due to collisions of enormous black holes, you know, 30, 40 times bigger than the mass of our sun. And so this is a wonderful new thing. I mean, I've said earlier that, you know, all our experiments are actually taking photos of the universe. Well, gravity waves are like finally being able to hear it for the first time. So we can finally get some sound information. And the really interesting thing about this is because it's so new, even single events can actually give us lots of insight. And so the first thing was a detection of two black holes colliding, the very first detection we had. And that was enough to change the way our models of how galaxies formed. Because actually the way we thought galaxies formed didn't produce enough black holes at this particular mass. And then recently we had two neutron stars colliding, which is really interesting because that gave us a gravitational wave signal, but also we could see it. And being able to see that essentially the gravitational waves and light went at the same speed was enough to rule out half of our models of how we could modify gravity in a single measurement. And so I think this gravity wave one is also a really exciting new development. It gives a real new window onto the universe and hopefully will help us sort of break down some of these remaining problems of, you know, what are these constituents of our model that we have.
Okay, that's definitely going to keep you and your colleagues and students busy for some time. And I'm glad there are people like yourself and your colleagues looking at gravity waves, dark matter and dark energy, while the rest of us deal with more mundane things. So it's definitely been a truly fascinating discussion, Dr. Ferguson, and many thanks for taking time to speak with us about your work and how Superdome Flex and in-memory computing is assisting you and your fellow cosmologists. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And to our listeners, please stay tuned for future HPE Mission Critical Solution podcasts. Indeed, we've got an upcoming one on artificial intelligence by an HPE fellow. So please stay tuned for that. So until next time, thank you for listening.